Yeah, that was going to come now. Got your next exam. We got today's content. We got Thursday's content. Then exam number two, I will open it up for you guys Thursday night, and we'll stay open until Sunday, unless you're one of the sports people. And then you will contact me upon your return. Because, again, I don't know what the schedule's like out in Florida. I don't know if you'll have internet, so I'd rather have you just worry about it when you come back. Because that's a school-related function anyways. And it's going to cover all the stuff since the since the first exam. So the Renaissance and the Age of Exploration. Then we'll come back after break, and then we'll start working on the stuff for the third. We're going to talk about the rise of the modern political state, so the emergence of modern kingships. I think we do the Age of Exploration, Scientific Revolution, that kind of stuff. Oh, we also have the Protestant Reformation. We got lots of good stuff. But we got to get through this. So we left off talking about the transatlantic slave trade. Again, a couple of key points to remember for the people who were alive and involved. It had nothing to do with morality. It was all about economics. It's all about money, wealth generation. And it was no different than people have been doing since the dawn of recorded history. It did not become a moral issue until the 18th century. So during this time, it was no big deal. Plus, let us not forget that the Arabs, the Muslims, had been raiding Africa for 1,000 years before the first Europeans showed up. So, yeah, we just got to keep things in context. And of course, like I said, that's one of the reasons why it's important to learn history. Because today's standards are different. Today we value every human individual. So such behavior would not be tolerated. Do you live in a barn? Huh? Do you live in a barn?
I live in a barn?
Yeah, you live in a barn.
Maybe.
Oh, all right. Just curious.
Because you usually leave the barn door open. But home doors? Yeah, homes. Because you don't want to let the cows come in.
All right. So, she's got a good sense of humor, right? All right, so, just appreciate the fact that we don't live back then. But we got to finish off with this because, as I said, the whole reason why the slave trade was created because the Spanish needed laborers because the disease that they brought with them, that they did not know they brought with them, killed off large swaths of the Native American population. So in order for Spain to make the lands they conquered profitable, they needed laborers. So that's why they utilized the Portuguese contacts. It's the reason why they extracted human beings and brought them over to the New World. But how did it impact? Well, I'm sure you learned it this way in high school. You learned it as the triangle trade, because essentially that would be created. Instead of ships just going back and forth between Europe and the New World, now suddenly you had a third leg on the triangle. And of course, each stop along the way would contribute to the economic well-being of the home state. We still have, like we talked about when we just began with our mercantilist empires, you still have the colonies producing resources, shipping them to the mother country. You still have the motherland taking some of those goods, making them into manufactured goods, and shipping them back to the colonies. That's still there. But now you have more customers. Because the African chieftains wanted the same thing that the Europeans do. You know, that's one of the amazing things about human beings. We're not different based on race. We all want the same thing. We all want more, more, more. So what did the African chieftains want? They wanted more money. They wanted more land. They wanted more power. And they wanted the good stuff that was coming out of the New World. So some of the ships, some of them were diverted directly over to Africa, but most went to Europe, reloaded, then came down on the coast. And they used whatever goods they were to procure through exchange the labor, the chattel, that would work in the Spanish and the Portuguese, and then later the English colonies. course, that's what came out of Africa, the property. And the whole reason why all this happened was because of money.
The crown wanted more wealth, which they could hire more soldiers and explorers and conquer more land to produce more resources, which still made more money.
More. Should have finished this the other day, but ran out of time. So, questions? Well, at the same time the Spanish were conquering and established their imperial system, the Portuguese both literally and proverbially took a different path than the Spanish. The Portuguese decided they did not want to use conquistadors. They did not want to try to conquer and topple existing systems. Instead, they wanted to generate wealth by using their manpower to control the flow of goods. They were content to be the middlemen. Think of UPS. Think of FedEx. Corporations that make millions of dollars per year simply taking the goods that someone is selling or making and dropping them off to the person who's buying them. That's essentially what the Portuguese wanted to do. Because there's less overhead. You don't have to have factories and warehouses. There's less manpower needed. And there's less chances of you being destroyed in war.
Now, as significant as Columbus is for the Spanish, Vasco da Gama was equally significant for the Portuguese.
It was da Gama who, following the path of all of those Portuguese explorers going back to Prince Henry, that slowly started going down the coast and making contacts and friendly relationships with the African chieftains, would eventually get to the Cape of Good Hope and would continue to progress towards his goal, the Orient. Da Gama traveled with four ships. He would sail. By the way, it took him 5 months just to get to the Cape of Good Hope. And then it would take him several more months to reach his destination. Now, as he traveled, he was looking for two things. He was looking for Christians, and he was looking for ports to resupply. But unfortunately, once he got around the Cape of Good Hope, because again, he was going to all of the African ports that the Portuguese had good relations to, but the moment he came around and started going northward, much to his anger and shock and horror, he discovered that all of the major ports on the western coast, or the eastern coast of Africa, were controlled by Muslims. And what's the problem with this? Well, don't forget, the whole reason why the Portuguese are going around Africa is so they don't have to do business with the Muslims. Now, here is the truth. Some of the Muslims focused on religion, jihad, and they were hostile to the Christians. And by the way, the same is true with any religion. You have extremists. But most of the people of any religion, they're not extremists. They just want to get along. So as luck would have it, da Gama mapped out those places like Malindi, Mozambique, which were controlled by Muslims that didn't focus on religion, but were focused on the only thing that should make the world go around. This stuff. This is the only color that should matter to anybody. The green stuff. So, because these ports were willing to do business with anybody, because they were in business for business' sake, they were able to get fresh supplies, water, foodstuffs. But the most significant contact he made was with the Sultan of Malindi, who gave to him a pilot, an experienced navigator who had for many years been crossing the Indian Ocean and landing at the southern tip of India. Because as the Gama would learn in Malindi, there were vast cities in India that were nothing but marketplaces. And all of the stuff of the world could be procured. So that's where he wanted to go. So with the help of the pilot, he easily navigated across and would land in Calicut. Now, of course, this was significant because for the last 80 years, the Portuguese have been trying to get to here. And when Da Gama suddenly landed in India, he proved that it was possible. That the Europeans didn't need the old Silk Road. That the Europeans didn't need to do business with the Ottomans. But instead, they could get to where the good stuff was directly and bring it home by sea. He would arrive in Calicut, which is on India's, what's called down here, Malabar coast. And Calicut was an ancient, thriving commercial hub. For hundreds of years, merchants from around Asia had been traveling to Calicut and getting stuff. Not by buying it, but through bargained for exchange. Negotiating agreements. I have 1 pound of flour. You have 1 pound of grapes. Can we exchange? No, you'll give me a half a pound for a pound. Fine, because I really want some grapes. They bargained. They negotiated. Another thing that was amazing to the Portuguese, this city was dominated by Hindus. And Hindus were tolerant. They didn't care about a person's race. They didn't care about a person's religion. They invited all to come in to trade. And oh my God, the quantities that were described by Da Gama were infinite. Spices, textiles like silk, cotton, and other Asian products were available in quantities that even if you were to fill up an entire boat, you wouldn't make a dent out of it. It was epic because Da Gama knew how much all of these items would fetch on the markets back in Portugal. He knew, and his crew knew, they are now all rich men. But the bad news was how the system operated. In order to get stuff, you had to have something of value to trade. And as the Portuguese took off the items that they had in their hulls to bargain with, none of the people in the markets wanted anything. The local merchants had no use for cast iron pots or glass beads or coral, or wool. And nothing of value. They were up against the wall. But then, out of sheer luck, Da Gama was listening. And he discovered that there actually was something that he had a small supply of whose value was out of proportion with the value that it was in Europe. The king had gave him a small bag of emergency silver coins that he was to use to buy supplies if necessary. Now, the coins were not what the value was, but rather the metal, the specie. Because silver in Asia naturally is rare.
So in the mind of the ancients, silver was actually worth more than gold. They believed it had mystical properties.
They were willing to take the silver at all costs because a few precious coins were of immense value in Asia. So he took the emergency stash and bought enough to fill the hulls with just a few coins. Well, I don't think he had more than 100. He was able to fill up the hulls of two ships. And when he got back to Europe, the ships, he would make 60 times the cost of the entire expedition.
There's a lesson in that. So, back, I know it's not the same because nowadays for you youngins, you youths, there's cell phone technology, there's credit cards and the like. But back when I was a kid, kids didn't get credit cards.
There was no cell phones. The only way you could call someone if you're away from home is by stopping at a payphone, if you happen to be in an area where there was payphones. And gas stations were not open 24 hours. So my grandfather told me when I started driving, he said, "Jesse, never leave the house without an emergency stash. Ever since I've been 16 years old, I've always kept a $20 bill tucked in my wallet in a slot that I never think of. That's there just in case of emergency.
I don't need it anymore, but I still do it out of habit. I've been doing it for, Christ, 35 years, 36 years.
But it's the same scenario there. The whole purchase of the bag of silver was just in case an emergency. And Da Gama realized, holy cow, fabulously rich, fabulously wealthy. But this would be a game changer. It would set a precedent that would remain in place for the next 400 years. Actually, it's still going on today. I know, being an idea roll. If the Europeans were going to get something of value from Asia, they couldn't trade, but rather they had to buy it. Which, of course, would create a conundrum. Where are they going to get the silver from? Well, you want to know why the transatlantic slave system boomed? Why the Spanish and the Portuguese were so invested in trying to make the New World profitable? Well, there you go. What the New World produced were the items that would generate the silver, which would then be brought to Asia to buy the Asian goods, which then could be brought back and sold for 10, 15, 20, 30 times the actual costs.
So, they're not going to trade to get the stuff. They're going to buy the goods, and that's how profit's going to be made. Questions? And what would you do if you had a chance to become rich? Just for 2 years' work.
Well, we have to be fair. The only reason why this was possible, because Da Gama was also able to apply new technology. Europeans had reached a level, thanks to the Venetians and their constant redevelopment of sailing ships, that the Europeans had technology that overwhelmingly, head above shoulders, surpassed that of the level of the technology available anywhere else on Earth. So not only did they have the ability to get in a wooden box and safely sail halfway around the world, the Europeans were also motivated by greed as well as curiosity. They wanted to know what was just beyond the horizon. They wanted to know what was around the corner because they wanted to know if there were other opportunities to make money. The Africans could have done it, but they didn't. The Asians could have done it, but they didn't. It was the Europeans who were motivated. And thus, this in part explains why the Europeans would come to dominate the earth. And thus, we have the global consequences. This little trip would change the course of human history. Now, the Middle Easterners, the Muslims, had already penetrated India. The Muslims already had access to the flow of goods, but they refused to let them go beyond into Europe because of religious hostility. But now, the Europeans were in direct competition. They could remove larger quantities. They had something more valuable than what the Muslims could bring. And thus the Indians and the Vietnamese and the Chinese were more willing to do business with the Europeans than they were the Muslims. But that's not to say the Muslims would be pushed aside. No, 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 no. Those would be hard ties to break. But in time, eventually the Europeans would come to dominate the flow of goods on a global level. Questions? It's really simple. It's not that complicated. Now, almost immediately upon the return of Da Gama, the Portuguese were willing to send out the next expedition. This next expedition would be captained by Pedro Cabral. He would depart with 13 ships and several chests of silver. He was ordered to establish permanent trade relations, to make that permanent connection with Calicut. So the Portuguese could always come in, could always get the good stuff. But he screwed up. He had good ships, but he didn't have radar. He didn't have GPS technology. So once he sailed out to the Canary Islands to resupply, get fresh water, instead of going down along the African coast, he got blown off course and ended up at Cape Verde, which he planted the flag in the name of the Portuguese, and then continued onwards, and then down about here, he struck land. Now, he believed, because he didn't go around the whole coast, that he simply just found a large island. So he also would plant the flag in the name of the Portugal. But of course, we know today he discovered Brazil. And Brazil would remain a Portuguese possession all the way up into the 19th century. And that's the reason why if you ever talk to anyone from Brazil, they're the only country in South America that does not speak Spanish. They speak Portuguese. All right. Did the Portuguese ever realize what they discovered? What Cabral discovered, yeah. Because at this point, and again, we're not going into all the explorations. We don't have time to cover them all. But if you do go through your chapter, I think it does mention, you know, by 1505, 1510, there were dozens of different expeditions that were being launched by the Spanish and the Portuguese because they were trying to figure out what the heck this blob over here was. The place that Columbus claimed was Asia. Well, one of those expeditions in 1501 was carrying a cartographer, a map maker, by the name of Americo Vespucci. Now, history tells us that Vespucci actually traveled over to the New World four times. Unfortunately, history is also lost physical proof of his first and his last trip. He mentions it in some letters, but there's nothing surviving, like records or a list, recognition in a government. There's nothing showing that he was actually on the first and the fourth. But we do know for the second trip, he traveled under the Spanish flag. But it was on the third voyage that he traveled for the Portuguese. And it's the third voyage which ultimately would make him famous to history. Upon his return, and this expedition was to get around the island that Cabral had reported, but they traveled much of the coastline. It's in a letter that Vespucci would be the first person to write down that Columbus was wrong. He realized that this was in fact not Asia, but rather it was a new land, uncharted, undiscovered. But he was a man of letters. So when he wrote his letters, he wrote them in Latin. And in his letter, he tells his friend, point blank, what Columbus actually discovered. He called Mundus land, Novus new. Today we refer to this phrase as being the New World. Now, when Vespucci's story, all his letters were collected and published in a book, the compiler sent a copy to Vespucci. Vespucci, when he signed off on it, would sign his name in Latin. Not the Italian, Amerigo Vespucci, but rather the Latin, Americus Vespucius. The printer, however, for whatever reason, used the feminized version of his first name, America. And this is the reason why North and South America are referred to that, because of this guy, who was the first one to claim Columbus was wrong. And obviously that name stuck, because we're still in America today. Question. Getting back to Cabral. Cabral would slowly make his correction, would sail across the South Atlantic Ocean. He would actually get caught in a storm. He would lose six of his ships. But eventually he would make his way up to Malindi, and with the assistance of the Sultan of Malindi, he too would travel across the Indian Ocean and arrive in Calicut. Upon his arrival, he would do what he was ordered. He would meet with the leader of the city. Not that you need to remember it, but the position was called the Zamorin. And through negotiators, he actually reached a deal. The Zamorin would give rights to the Portuguese to buy and maintain what the Europeans at this time referred to as a factory. I'm assuming you all know what the modern meaning of a factory is, right? Is there anyone who does not? Okay, good. That's good. Well, a factory at this time was more of a reference to a warehouse. So what this was a big building that the Portuguese would basically go into the city and obtain quantities of goods, and they would bring them back and store them in the factory, where they would be guarded, because there were soldiers there. And it would stay in the building until the Portuguese ships arrive. Then the quantities would be moved from the warehouse and brought to the ships. So contained within the factory, you had warehouses, you had barracks for the soldiers. It was fortified. There was some type of wall usually built around it, watchtowers and so forth. Because basically the goal was to start just amassing quantity. Well, they operated successfully for 2 months. And then, for some reason, bless you,
a group of about 100 Muslims attacked the factory and set it on fire. It would actually burn it to the ground.
In the process, 60 Portuguese men were killed. Cabral himself barely made it to the ships.
The survivors got on board, they undocked, sailed into the harbor. Now, we don't know why the Muslims attacked. It could have been religious. It could have been they didn't want competition. We just don't know.
But we just know the results. Cabral would actually contact the Zamorin, and he would demand justice. He wanted those responsible to be caught and punished for what they did. Because that's what would happen in Europe. That was the European standard of justice. But the Zamorin replied, there's no warranties here. There's no guarantees. You do business at your own risk. Cabral was furious. So what does he do? He orders his ship to open fire on the city. They fired several volleys.
And then they sat and waited. They waited for someone in the city to fire back. But you know something? Not a single shot came back.
Because there were no defenses in the city. Which, of course, caused Cabral to sit back and say,
If I have a gun and I point it at your head, what can I get you to do? Anything I want, right? Cabral realized these people didn't have cannon. They didn't have artillery. That if he went in and acted like a thug, he could get whatever he wanted. Because there was no way for them to fire back.
So needless to say, when he returned back to Portugal, he reported this. So going forward for the next 2 decades, that was the attitude of the Portuguese. If you go in there, you can intimidate these people. We can take from them what we want. We can do to them what we want. Because might makes right.
Well, these 2 expeditions would be a huge turning point for the mercantilist countries. Huge turning point.
Because now they had access to the wealth of the Orient. And if they could access it, they could become wealthier beyond their imagine. Same thing with the subjugation of the New World. Wealth beyond imagine. Europe was no longer limited to what they could produce on their tiny little European countries. But by establishing global empire, they can now have limitless land, producing limitless money. Which of course translates to limitless power. The funny thing is, there's dozens and dozens and dozens of contemporary sources in Europe. All of the intellectuals were fascinated by the possibilities. But if you turn your eyes to in Asia, there's no reference. There is actually no first-hand accounts of the Portuguese arriving in Calicut. None survive. Because for the Asians, these were just another group of merchants. These were just another group of people that were looking to trade. They were no different than anybody else who walked the streets of the city. So, in Europe, this was the equivalent of a nuclear explosion. In Asia, it wasn't even a fart. It wasn't even a blip. But now the fun part begins. Why? Well, this is why.
What the Portuguese stumbled upon was something beyond the imaginations of those people alive in 1500. They didn't just sail across halfway around the earth and arrive in some foreign land. No, 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 no. What they stumbled upon was an interconnected trading network that had been operating for hundreds of years.
Hundreds of years. Calicut, even the port cities of Africa, they were just stopping points along a flow of sea routes that interconnected Africa, the Middle East, the subcontinent, and India, going as far north as Korea and Japan. Thousands of miles, goods were transported through the entirety of this network. You could go into Africa and you could get stuff that was produced in Korea, and vice versa. Oh, minimize that window. Boo. Or was that someone getting an instant message? I don't know that sound effect. So, what do we got going on here? Well, truth be told, you had three major zones and a whole bunch of minor zones. China, India, and the Middle East were the three major zones. From the Middle East, you could get glass, you could get carpets, you could get tapestries. From India, their major commodities that they put into the flow of goods, tea and cotton. China, silk, paper, porcelain. Those were the major goods that the major zones traded for. And what they could get was all the stuff that came from the in-between points. From the Indonesia and some of the islands came many of the spices that mom and dad have in their kitchen cabinets. You could get iron or wood that came as far away as Korea. You could get ivory from Africa. You could get gems. You could get rice from Southeast Asia. You could get livestock from the Bay of Bengal. Anything you could imagine. All of these peoples were producing whatever they were producing, but they were taking the surplus and sending it into this vast interconnected network. It's like Walmart on crack. You can go to Walmart and get anything you want. Well, because of this network, you could get anything that was available throughout two-thirds of the earth. And you could get it in India, you could get it in the Middle East, you could get it in Africa, you could get it in Japan. It was all possible. And while the ships weren't that good, the primary movers of the goods were Muslim pilots and merchants that kind of hopped the coastline all the way to about here. And then the rest of it was pretty much dominated by Chinese ships. They didn't have ocean-going vessels, but their boats were good enough that they could carry large tons, quantities of items. And whereas the Europeans traveled by the position of the sun and the stars, the Chinese invented the compass. So the merchants were comfortable going into the open waters of the South China Sea, knowing that they could find the sweet spots in Indonesia and getting all the way to India and so forth. It was unbelievable. But again, keep in mind, it had been going for hundreds of years. The Portuguese simply stumbled upon it. But let me tell you, when they went back to Europe and they told what they saw, what they could get in just one marketplace, it started triggering the imaginations of people in London, in Paris, and elsewhere. Questions? Well, shortly after their arrival, the Portuguese pretty much recognized two things that would make exploiting the network possible. And by the way, both of these points would be critical to the Europeans and their eventual domination of the trade network. Now keep in mind, unlike what the Spanish did to Central and South America, the Europeans didn't conquer. They made deals with local leaders who were willing to work with them. Now, one of the reasons that would allow the Europeans to do so, and of course it would be realized by the Portuguese, is that no one was in charge of this. There was no central corporation or company or even kingdom that ruled the whole network. It was open, and it was pretty much controlled by merchants, businessmen. And these businessmen had no sense of a common cause. You know, they weren't working for a king, but rather they were motivated by profit. And it always boils down to the famous saying, what would you do for a Klondike bar? If you wanted a Klondike bar, what would you do? Would you sell out your people? Would you sell out your country? If you really wanted one. So, the Chinese, the Southeast Asians, the Indians, they were willing to let anybody come in because they all wanted the same thing, profit. And second, the network operated on handshakes, gentlemen's deals. There was no formality, there was no structure, and there definitely was no military presence. There was no need to have soldiers because everybody in the network wanted something. The only real threat to the network were pirates, but most of the Asian and Muslim ships had small little like shoulder cannons that they could fight the pirates off with. But once you got into the port, anyone could come in. Anyone could do business. And by the way, the system operated for hundreds of years because everyone who participated was willing to agree to that. But you know who wasn't? The Portuguese.
They recognized this and they saw opportunity.
They saw opportunity. Questions? But just because they could get there, just because they could get in, that didn't mean that the Portuguese could take control. Again, we're talking a single drop of water being dropped into the equivalent of the Pacific Ocean. That one little drop goes unnoticed. So how could the Portuguese take control? Well, the biggest problem they had was that it's not like they could produce something at home, which would be cheap, which would be easy. No, the only thing they had available of wealth was gold and silver. Silver more so than gold. So, if the Portuguese are going to get rich off of this, they have to get their hands on lots of gold and silver. So what does this mean? Well, I've already mentioned it. Transatlantic slave trade. They are going to bring over as many human beings to satiate the demands of the Spanish. If the Spanish want 1 million people, the Portuguese are going to try to get them 1 million people because the Spanish paid for the chattel in the gold and silver that they were mining out of the Inca mines. So they would then take that gold and silver, put it on a ship, and ship it over to Asia to buy the spices and the silks and all the rest. But the more wealth they brought over, that also could be a problem. Because the whole reason for mercantilism is generating money for the crown. So in order for them to make money by controlling the Asian trade network, they're simultaneously doing kind of the exact opposite of what the kings want. The king wants the wealth for themselves, but now you have to take a good part of it and send it into the flow of goods, the flow of commerce. Of course, if you use it all, then the crown goes bankrupt. There's revolution. Dynasties come to an end. That's the exact opposite of the whole point of what Machiavelli wrote. Plus, the more money you use, the Muslims are also making money off the deal because they're bringing a lot of the goods to the different major ports. And the whole reason about going around Africa was to not do business with the Muslims anymore. So, you put these four factors together and they're in an unwinnable situation. A catch-22. A conundrum. So, how did the Portuguese deal with this? Well, this is the reason why they decided we're going to force our way in. We're going to act like thugs. We're going to intimidate. We're going to shake the people down. They believed they could offset their inferiority in terms of numbers with the superiority of their ships and their weapons. No one in Asia had the firepower even remotely equivalent to what one Portuguese ship could bring. Oh, by the way, tonight on FX is Shogun, which tells a fictional story of the arrival of a Portuguese ship in ancient Japan. If you ever have nothing to do, watch it. I think it starts at like 9 or 10 o'clock at night. I'm very excited about it. I heard it was really, really good. But it just goes to show exactly what I'm talking about.
The natives had whatever their weapons were, swords, spears, bows, and arrows, but the Europeans arrived with muskets and cannon and artillery.
So even one ship could be a threat to an entire kingdom. And the Portuguese were willing to do it.
Another interesting thing was, there was no social division in Portugal. You know, anytime our government does anything, regardless of who the president is or whichever party's in Congress, whenever our government does anything, right off the bat, half of the people in the country hate it. They're against it. They're opposed it because we don't compromise anymore.
We are so divided as a country, it's disgusting. Well, there was no division with Portugal. Every letter that I've read from this time period, whether it be a noble or a commoner, they all saw opportunity. By working together, everyone could get rich.
It's the same thing I wish you were guys taught from the moment you're in kindergarten. We're all in this together. We all got to just get along. Because at the end of the day, if we as a country do well, our standard of living goes up and we all benefit. You know, when the tide comes in, all ships rise.
Well, the Portuguese realized this. So even though they had small numbers, they were united. There was no social division because everybody wanted a taste. So they were willing to do anything and everything to go in and make this profitable. The unity allowed them to take advantage of divisions in Asia and also to take advantage of the Asians' inability to stop them. So, Da Gama's second expedition, 1502, he was actually able to force several ports in Africa and in India to submit to Portugal. And Da Gama forced them to pay tribute to him. Just like what the mafia did when they controlled New York City or New Jersey. They'd go into a business and basically say, hey, I want 10% of your business or we're going to burn your building down. Well, that's what the Portuguese did to these people. And initially the people were like, don't blow us up. So, the Portuguese started making money off of threats of violence. Unfortunately, this was short-lived.
Within 5 years, the six ports that Da Gama subjugated, the people unified and they fought back. And they threw the Portuguese out.
So when that occurred, the Portuguese were so motivated, they changed tactics. Suddenly they realized they couldn't conquer and subjugate existing cities. But rather, it would be better for them to start building their own. So instead of terrorizing,
what they began doing along the coastline is finding good ports that had little or no people living there. So they then would contact the local government and say, hey, can we set up a base of operation here? In exchange, we'll give you gold, we'll give you silver.
From those locations, which they could fully defend, they opened up new factories. And these ports would serve as pivot points.
Because what the Portuguese would attempt to do next is to seize control of trade routes.
So for example, Did you know, or maybe you did not,
that nutmeg, cloves, not clover, but cloves, mace, cinnamon, that those spices originally all came from single islands. Most of them were islands in Indonesia. The whole world supply came from one place. Well, the Portuguese found this out.
And so what they attempted to do was basically make deals with the farmers only to give them all of their product. The Portuguese would then take a boatload of cloves, or nutmeg, and then go sail into the markets and then exchange those goods. They realized instead of producing, which costs money, and instead of manufacturing, which costs money, they would let somebody else produce it, and they simply would transport it. They realized there was money to be made by literally operating, like I said previously, as UPS. They wanted to be the transporters of the goods. So what did they do? They sunk all of their efforts into trying to establish monopolies on shipping certain products. This ultimately would become known as the Portuguese system. This empire, all technically owned by the king, so the ships, the factories, the ports, but they would be operated locally in Asia. And the goal was to establish these monopolies. Unfortunately for the Portuguese, there was one flaw to this. Spices are, or come from, plants. Where can you plant a plant? In the dirt. Which dirt? Dirt. Where's can you find dirt?
Everywhere.
So the problem that the Portuguese would run into in trying to establish these monopolies is there would be certain farmers that didn't want to do business with the Portuguese. They found them to be abrasive, obnoxious, particularly when they started bringing over Jesuit priests, trying to convert them all to Catholicism. So what did these farmers do? Well, they would simply take up their plants and they would move to another island to get away from the Portuguese. So what ended up happening is the Portuguese trying to control the system in the end would burn themselves out. They would bankrupt their empire. And coincidentally, by the end of the 16th century, by around 1590, 1600, literally the first empire to be established, the first people to go out, ended up going belly up. They went bankrupt. Portugal was so weak that for about 30 years, Spain actually invaded and conquered it and took them over. And then they would lose control in Asia.
But, not that we're going to come back to the age of exploration, but I do talk about this in global history. The moment the Portuguese fell, the door was open. And soon the Dutch, and then the English, and then the French would all make their way over around Africa, end up in Asia, and they essentially would attempt to do the exact same thing.
Questions? No? Move away from the Portuguese. we'll start the English and then we'll call it a day. Because it wasn't just the Portuguese doing it. It was also, like I said, the English and the French.
But it would take about 150 years before the English made their way over into Asia. But they would first set their sights on the New World as well.
Mercos Vespucius, Mundus Novus, the New World. And ironically, the English arrived at the same time the Portuguese were conquering Central and South America.
England's move from being an island nation into a mercantilist empire traces its origins back to Henry VII, father of the more famous Henry VIII. Henry VII was a very shrewd, money-focused king. He was the founder of the Tudor dynasty. He won power after winning the War of the Roses. And he sought to revitalize the economy of his kingdom. How? The same as Ferdinand and Isabella. The same as John II of Portugal.
The same as those African chieftains. Henry wanted more, more, more.
Now, ironically, Henry VII was on the throne at the point when Vasco da Gama got around, found the Cape of Good Hope because of emissaries and ambassadors. He heard about this. He was still on the throne when Columbus sailed across the ocean blue, came back, reported to Madrid. He found a route to Asia. Well, when Henry is hearing all this, he decides, I want in too.
'95, an Italian merchant who first tried going to Portugal, tried going to Spain before making his way up to London, would arrive
with an opportunity. Giovanni Caboto, or maybe when you were in high school, you learned about him as the Anglicanized version of his name, John Cabot. Caboto had the same map that Columbus did, had the same belief that Columbus did, that the world was round and it was simply a matter of just going around the earth. And he presented an opportunity to Henry.
His plan was simple.
Unlike Columbus, who decided to sail in and around the equator at the point when the earth was the biggest, what he proposed was sailing in a more northerly direction. Because what happens to the circumference of a ball when you start going up towards the top? It gets smaller. So he basically comes up with the simple notion, look, I'll sail north, I'll get there quicker, which means you can get your taste way before the Spaniards can. And Henry, being the opportunist, says, fine, I'm all on board. So, same or similar deal to what the Portuguese gave. Henry paid for the ships, but gave Caboto a commission that would allow him to take in 75% of whatever he discovered. Henry would get 25%. So, Cabot goes out, finds the ships, give the king a bill, hires the crew, sets sails. His first voyage, he set sail in November 1496. Unfortunately, the seas, because they were in the midst of the little ice age, it was much colder than it is today, and the seas were more savage. And after sailing out into the waters and being blown to the north and blown to the south, Cabot basically said, after hearing a sound on one of his ships, kind of terrified him, he decided he's going to come back. He's going to wait till the spring, till the waters are cooler. So he turns around, complete failure. Second voyage, however, was successful. He set sail in June and successfully traversed the Atlantic and would make landfall in a place not exactly sure, but modern scholars believed somewhere in this region, from the Great Northern Peninsula, possibly here, or maybe as far south as Nova Scotia. Not exactly sure. Now, according to the accounts that survive, Cabot did in fact go on land. He in fact did plant the flag for the king and for the Catholic Church. But he only stayed on land long enough to take in fresh water and to chop down some trees for some fresh lumber. Now, he does discuss potential human beings. He didn't have any contact with them, but he did report finding the remains of fire, of a human-made trail, some nets, and some primitive wood tools. But he never saw anybody because he ordered his men not to go farther from the shoreline than a crossbow bolt could travel. So after getting supplies, they all got back in the boats and they sailed southerly. They mapped out some more land. Again, we're not exactly sure, but based on what he drew, modern scholars believed it was possibly Newfoundland. And then after about a week, he turned around and sailed back. The following year, he planned to set sail again, planning to depart in May. But no record survives. We don't even know if he actually left. We don't know if he found anything, because we don't know if he came back. All there was, all that survives, is one reference in one of Henry VII's ledgers, funding for more ships. That's all that survives. So it's possible he went out into the Atlantic and his boat went and he sunk and he died. We just don't know. But that's the danger of going across the ocean in a wooden box. But it's also possible that he went and he came back, because when you look through the sources, the English were not undeterred. They were very much like the Spanish. They began sending out more and more expeditions because they were trying to figure out, was this really Asia? But the English did things a little differently. In 1499, an English noble by the name of William Weston, who had enough money to buy his own ships, undertook an expedition. We don't know exactly where he went, but we know, generally speaking, he sailed along the same access point as Cabot did on his second expedition. And it's believed that he touched base in Newfoundland and sailed possibly as north as the Hudson Strait, because he did two important things. He referenced what he called Newfoundland, and he gave reference to what infamously drove North American expeditions for 200 years. Weston labeled some water entranceway as the Northwestern Passage, a possible water route to get around or through whatever this was. But that's all we know. Northwest Passage, Newfoundland. Following year, 1500, another English wealthy noble by the name of Hugh Elliot was actually given a charter from Henry to explore what the English were calling Newfoundland. So Elliot made three voyages. No details survive other than he kept going back to a place that he called the Island of New Finding. It's possible it was just Newfoundland. Could have been Nova Scotia. Not quite. Could have been Arcadia. We don't know. We don't know if he discovered anything. We just know he went over three times. They didn't exactly keep good records. The last of the significant early explorers was Giovanni's son, Sebastiano. Or you might have learned about him as Sebastian Cabot. Sebastiano would make two trips. No exact details of the first. Other than there was references to the fact that he brought back a whole lot of salted cod. Because the English like fish and chips. So apparently his men spent a whole amount of time fishing over here, took the fish on land, cut them open, gutted them, and salted them. Why would you salt fish?
Preserve it.
There's no refrigeration. Like jerky. But it was second trip that's the more famous, because a lot of details survive. He apparently tried going to Weston's Newfound Passage, only to get in there and kind of realize, yeah, maybe that's not a waterway all the way through. For some reason, actually, it was really cold up there, and he also mentioned the fact that there was floating ice. So he decided to attempt to go southerly, and he brought back a map, which somewhat accurately showed the coast of North America all the way down to modern North Carolina, including listing the Chesapeake Bay. So America was open to the British because Cabot reported there's no cities, there's no major ports, there's just vast open land. But, and this is where we're going to end it because our time is up. Unfortunately, when Sebastian returned from his second trip in April 1509, the situation in England had changed. His sponsor, Henry VII, was dead. And his successor, as we'll touch upon when we come back, Henry VIII, was not interested in more, like his father was. Instead, as we're going to see when we talk about the Protestant Reformation, he had other things on his mind. Does anybody know what it was? Which ultimately resulted in him having six wives? Anyone know what Henry VIII wanted? Why a son? There you go. That's good. That's what a king needs to do. Have a son to have a dynasty. All right, so you sports players, good luck down in Florida. I will get the recording up as soon as possible so we have a chance. Listen to it, take some notes. Send me emails when you're back.
and you'll tell me when you want to take the exams. Everybody else, plan on taking the exams, like I said. I'll open them up Thursday afternoon, and they'll stay open until Sunday. We're going to finish up with the English when we come back on Thursday. We'll talk about the French, and that will be it for exam two. So if you're working on any of the section review questions in the reader, those will be due by Sunday as well. Hi.
Is the exam timed?
Just like the first one.
And is there any extra credit in the exam?
Just like the first one. 30 multiple choice questions, two essays. One is required to get you 100, and if you do the second one, there's your extra potential 10 points. All right. Good luck, baseball and softball players. Everyone else will see you on Thursday.